So let me remind you where we stand. So yesterday, thank you, we saw that the thing we have now to focus on is on studying two-point functions of gauge invariant operators. Why do we have to do it? Because we understood that if we know all two and three-point functions in a gauge theory, we can construct any higher point function. That was one of our main motivations. Also because it's the most natural observable. It's just a correlation function of two operators. These objects, these dimensions that govern two-point functions, are directly related in conformal field theory to the energy spectrum of the conformal field theory when you put it in a sphere. And in ADS-CFT, those energies are nothing but energies of strings in moving in the ADS cylinder, which is this gravitational box. So what's the action for these strings? If we use this embedding coordinates, which is this picture where strings live in this hyperboloid and in the sphere, this is the action in Polyakov gauge. So you have a kinetic term, dA of x. And then you have a constraint that x squared needs to be equal to 1 implemented by a Lagrange multiplier. And you have a similar stuff for the ADS part. And you have to supplement this by the Vidazzara constraints. So here are the equations of motion. And as I emphasized last time, note that these equations of motion, they are very different from what we are used to when we start quantizing a theory. Like imagine we want to quantize this two-dimensional field theory, to want to quantize this string theory. Normally, in flat space, you just have d square of x equals 0. You don't have the second term. And what do? You just decompose the field into modes, promote the modes to oscillators, do canonical quantization, and so on. Now, how would you go about even starting that? Now you don't have just box of x equal to 0 or box of x plus m squared x equal to 0. You don't have something trivial that you can just expand into modes, start your canonical quantization, and so on. The starting point is intrinsically nonlinear. And this is a sign that the theory is strongly coupled. It's a strongly curved field theory. And even the starting point for quantization, if you just look at this equation of motion, what should be the analog of writing the solution as modes, of expanding in modes and quantizing those modes? Even that is actually highly non-trivial. And it is known, people know what is the analog of Fourier modes, what's the analog of Fourier frequencies, and so on. But it turns out to be quite subtle, and I might discuss it or not in these lectures later on. But for now, we are discussing classical solutions and studying these dimensions using classical string solutions at strong coupling. Now, what are the charges? The charges are given by square root lambda over 2 pi integral, and then we have different charges that we can consider. We can consider rotations along the y's. We have something like yA, yB dot minus yB, yA dot. This would be a rotation of yA into yB. And this will define some charge. Let's call it as AB. And similarly, let's define some JAB to be associated with rotations of axes among themselves. Now, more precisely, suppose you have strings moving in a sphere, or suppose you have some rotation symmetry, say some SO3 rotation symmetry. Let's start just with SO3. Okay? Now, it's true that you can have different angular momenta in SO3. In SO3, you can have, for a given total angular momenta, you can have different SZ components. Right? So how could you characterize this? How could you make a catalog, label, make a list of all possible string solutions without double counting? You could say that, okay, I consider strings that have this SO3 symmetry, but I only consider highest weights, for example. So I only consider strings such that the component of the angular momenta along z is the same as the total component of the angular momenta. The other ones I obtain by just applying rotations to this solution. Exactly like in a quantum mechanical system where I would have some total spin. And then I have representations with that total spin. And not to discuss solutions which are trivially related by just a rotation, I could decide I only focus on highest weights. The other ones I obtain by rotating. So just thinking about highest weights means that I should, what's the highest weight? A highest weight is an operator which has Sz equal to total S, with Sjz equal to total J, when it's J. What is Jz? Jz is the element, is the element of the algebra which is diagonal. So you know that whenever you have a Lie algebra, you have the Cartan subalgebra of the diagonal elements, right? And we can consider the states which have definite eigenvalue under the Cartan. And then the other ones are rotations of those. Okay, so all this blah blah just to tell you that we can consider some of these charges, which are the analog of the sigma z, and consider states that have definite charge under those axes, and all other ones are related by rotations. So the charges that we choose are the following. S minus 1, 0. What would you call this charge? It's rotation of y minus 1 and y 0. Remember that y minus 1 and y 0 rotations in this was what? Was energy, right? It was translation in this time. I remind you that in this picture in ADS, if this is the global cylinder, and this is time, just translation in time, a solution that was just moving in time, for example, was rotations along this, where here we have y minus 1, y 0, and y 1, and y 1, 2, and so on. So indeed, this is what we would call an energy. The other ones, let's say S1, 2, and S3, 4, we would call spins, S1 and S2. So this we would call spin. Then we have the ones in the sphere, and we say that J1, 2, J3, 4, and J5, 6, they are three angular momenta, because now we have not SU2, but we have SO6, which is the same as SU4. So there are three elements in the Cartan, not just JZ. And these three spins that parameterize completely the states, we call them J1, J2, J3. So this we call spin. These guys we call angular momenta. Yes. Why there are six components? Because remember, this is a five sphere, right? So there are six x's such that the sum of x squared is equal to 1. Okay, very good. Then, using these charges, we can learn something about the states that are dual to these strings. A state that has angular momenta will be translated when you have lots of angular momenta. This is dual to a state with lots of scalars. So in the gauge theory, for example, let's do that part. In the gauge theory, there are also six scalars, phi I, okay, also six like the x's. And there's also a symmetry. There's also a symmetry that rotates. So there is an SO6 symmetry also. Of course, it's exactly the same SO6 symmetry as we discussed in the first lectures. And in particular, we have a U1 symmetry that rotates phi1 and phi2. That rotates this field phi 1 into phi 2 and phi 1 into phi 2 and so on. So this defines a U1 charge, J1. And then we have the fields phi 3 and phi 4, and this defines a charge J2, and we have the rotations of the scalar phi 5 and phi 6, and this defines a charge J3. So for example, let's give an example. Trace, okay, then you can define a field Z, which is defined as phi 1 plus I phi 2, and the field Z bar, which is phi 1 minus I phi 2. And similar for the other guys, you can define an X, which is phi 3 plus I phi 4. And you can define a Y, which is phi 5 plus I phi 6. So for example, trace of Z square X square as J1 equal 2 and J2 equal 2. There's 2 units of this charge because it has 2 Z's, and it has 2 units of this charge U1 because it has 2 X's. Okay? So in general, trace of Z to the J1, X to the J2 as charge J1, J2, 0. Okay? So this is important because what we do is we study some classical solution in string theory and we read what the angular momentum of that solution is. That does not tell us completely what the state is, but at least, for example, it tells us how many scalars of each kind we have. Of course, this does not fix completely because there are different orders that I can put the scalars. I can put ZZXX or ZXZX. So there are different ways of rearranging the scalars. And that I cannot know just by this simple argument. But at least the number of each of them, the number of charges, that I can. And that's perfectly natural also. I mean, if I give you a string solution and just tell you what's the angular momenta, you cannot tell me what exactly is the string shape solution. You just know some information about some global information around the solution. What's the total angular momentum that it is spinning? It doesn't tell us the inner details. So, we studied yesterday a very simple solution. We studied the simplest possible solution. And that simplest possible solution was a solution that was just moving in the middle of ADS. And in the sphere, it was just a point-like string again. It was a point moving in the middle of ADS, and again a point going around one of the great circles. So this was just, this T was just kappa tau, and this angle phi was J times tau. And we saw that Virasoro said that the energy of this solution was equal to the angular momenta J, which was J1. And this was the main result that with which we ended yesterday's lecture. Now, you have an operator that only has charge J1. So this guy should be dual to an operator that only has charge J1. So in this case, we do know what the operator is exactly. It is just trace of Z to the J1. Because if I only have Z fields, then there's no ambiguity on how I multiply them, of course. Z times Z times Z is Z times Z times Z. There's no order here. Now, when lambda is 0, when lambda goes to 0, of course, the dimension of this operator is equal to J1. Is this clear? Because it's just a number of scalars. So you just connect the two operators and you have J1 propagators. So the dimension is just J1. So we see that when lambda goes to infinity, we get J1. When lambda goes to 0, we also get J1. And in fact, delta for this guy is equal to J1 for any coupling. So it's kind of a boring interpolating curve between weak and strong coupling. And this is a consequence of supersymmetry, the fact that this sits in a particular representation of the superconformal algebra. Okay, so I wanted to have written all this before the lecture start, but today I could not come before, so unfortunately, we are losing some time. Okay, any question about this? So let's move to the next interesting solution. So what was the particularity of this solution? Remember, this solution was the solution, the analog of having no modes excited. Now let's consider the solution with a single mode. Okay? So let me write to you what's the simplest solution. So it will be a solution which is still totally boring in EDS, T equal kappa tau. So still doing nothing in EDS, but in S5 it will be a circle, a circular string. So it's a very simple exercise, actually, and useful as well, so I will let you do it, to show that let's try to guess the nicest possible solution. X1 plus IX2. Remember, before it was e to the I j tau. Okay? So it was a point. Okay? So what would you do to make it, instead of a point, to make it extended and wrap the cylinder? And wrap the great circle?
Put some sigma dependence in the exponential.
Put some sigma dependence in the exponential. So let's do that. Plus I n sigma. Now, this is not a physical solution. Just that. Why is it not physical? Because it doesn't obey the Virasoro constraints. One way of seeing it, one physical way of seeing, is that we know that strings, longitudinal movement of the string is not physical movement, right? Because you know that if a string, imagine you have a piece of rubber that is rotating like this, just rotating like this. Okay, so you have a circle of rubber that is rotating like this. You know that it is rotating because, I mean, you can look at it and there are some imperfections and you see that the imperfections are following the piece of rubber. But if it was really, really perfect rubber, it would be rotating, then you would look at it, you would not know that it's rotating. And a string is like that. It's a string, you have some worksheet, and you can choose the grid that you want. You can put some grid that looks like the string is rotating or some grid that looks like the string is static. And you cannot distinguish between the two. So all this rotation, if I just put it in a circle and rotate it, it's not a physical movement. And this will translate into the fact that if you try to see if this obeys Virasoro, it does not. So you need to have something that looks like it has some movement. So let's do something like this Lisa Ju figures. So let's excite a string in another plane so that it's rotating in two planes at the same time, and then we can really have some non-trivial motion. So the next trivial thing that we can do, and by the way, another argument for why this could not be physical, is that this solution would only be moving in this plane, but we already identified the only possible candidate for a solution that only moves in this plane. So if there were another one, it would be a problem. So what we can do is put x3 plus ix4 equal to e to the I j tau minus I n sigma. So it's easy to see this is the simplest possible solution. Now this cannot be okay. There is one thing that I'm missing there. One small thing I need to fix, and then we can plug it into the equations of motion and check that it works. So why is it obvious that this is not good? It immediately violates something. What does it violate? It's not written, it's not this, this, or this, but actually it's something that I didn't write even, which is the constraint that it must be in the sphere. That's not in the sphere. You see, if you sum x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus x squared squared, you get 2. So to put it in the sphere, now we have to say, for example, put some 1 over square root of 2, 1 over square root of 2. Okay? Now it's in the sphere. And now I leave it as an exercise. I hope you, unless you want me to do it, to just plug it and check it goes through the equations of motion and everything. Just plug it here and check that it is true. Okay? Is it okay? In particular, so first of all, is it okay? Can I not do it? It is just plugging here and checking that you get 0 equals 0. Okay? Now, let's look here. This is more interesting. What are the charges of this solution? So, the energy, you see, it's the rotation of minus 1 and 1, is just kappa again. So for this solution, the energy is just again just kappa, some factor of square root of lambda. What is J1? J1 is the rotation between this x1 and x2, right? X1 and x2. Instead of getting J1, now because of this 1 over square root of 2, we get J over 2. And J2 is also J over 2. So this is a solution in this kind of universality class. It's a solution that has as many Z's as X fields. So this is dual to trace of Z to the J over 2, X to the J over 2, plus permutations, plus rearrangements. And what kind of rearrangements, what kind of operator, and so on, will be the purpose of tomorrow or after tomorrow. But we can already anticipate. Okay, and now you plug it into the equations of motion, you check that it goes through, and as usual, Virasoro tells you what's the relation between this kappa and this chase. Right? So you check that, you check periodicity, that's trivial, it's done. You check equations of motion, that's okay. You check that they are on the sphere, that's okay. And then Virasoro, you see, it's the only one that couples x's and y's. So it relates kappa, which is related to the energy, with curly j, which is related to angular momentum. And what you get is that the energy, delta, the energy delta is square root of j square plus lambda n square. Okay, so here is an interesting non-trivial solution. Okay. So this, for example, is a prediction. So now we claim that if we could compute the anomalous dimension of those kind of operators that contain Z's and X fields, and then you go to lambda large, that's how the dimension should behave of those kind of operators when lambda is large. Once we properly identify what exactly combination should we take. Because again, let me emphasize that, of course, there are many solutions with those charges. Right? We took one. That was the solution which was the simplest, in the sense that was the one that looks like just a single mode excited. So we have to identify, also in the gauge theory, what is the analog of this being the simplest and so on. We are now just starting to study this map. So for the previous case, there was no doubt, because there were J1 field Z, and that's it, so there was only one possible candidate. For this case, there are many possible ways of putting Z's and X's in many different orders. So we have to understand which one it is.
Sure.
Yes.
So now this in, like, the physical picture I had is like it's just the number of how this string will rotate.
That's right.
But now the energy depends on n.
Yes.
What is the physical meaning now of it?
No, I mean you can plot this solution. It lives in this plane, and it's. Whenever you look just at the plane x1, x2, it's a circle. Whenever you look at the plane x3, x4, it's a circle. But how are the points of the circle moving? It connects the two circles. So this is really, if you plot, for example, what's happening in the plane x1, x3, you do get some solution that is moving and so on, and it's extended. So it's really like this Lisa Zhu figures. Did you all do this thing that you go to the lab and you plug these figures that are circles in two planes, but in the other planes they are all these funny things. Did you try? No? Just plot this parametric plot of x1 and x3. It's quite cute. I mean, you get some. These are called Lisa Drew figures. I mean, yeah. It's exactly what you get when you plot in parametric form cosines and sines. It's exactly what we do in the lab when we do this electricity experiments with the oscilloscopium. I don't know how to translate. Is it oscilloscopium? Oscilloscopium? How is it?
Oscilloscopium.
Oscilloscopium. Okay. But again, it's just an exercise to check. Now, I was telling you, oh, these equations of motion, they are very hard, very nonlinear, and so on. But then the solutions that we see, they are just trivial exponentials, pretty much like in flat space. How come? Well, what am I telling? I'm telling you this is extremely hard to solve, and then all I draw is simple, all I write is simple exponentials. Well, this is because really we are studying the very, very simplest solutions, the ones with no modes or the ones with a single mode. If you try now, I leave you as an exercise to try to find another solution which has J1 equals J2. Try to start putting two exponentials or something and you will fail. So then it starts to become really hard. So when you try to go to more complicated solutions, there are, you can write them down, but they start involving Jacobi polynomials, elliptic functions, and already considerably more complicated solutions. And it's the purpose of tomorrow's exercise. For example, in the tutorial, you will study a famous solution. That is a solution that is boring in the sphere. Nothing is happening in the sphere, but it's non-trivial in ADS. And it's a folded string that's rotating in ADS, like imagine you have a rod that rotates in the center of ADS. So you solve the classical solution in flat space, which was the one where you got Reggie behavior, right? Which was also like a rod rotating, right? So this is exactly the analog, but now it's a rod that rotates in the middle of ADS. And because of moving in a curved space-time, you will get much more non-trivial and interesting functions compared to the ones you got in flat space. Okay. So, is there any question? So this is an important point right now, because now what we will do is we will switch gears, and for some time, for like 2 or 3 lectures, now we move to the gauge theory. We know now how to study energies, dimensions of operator at strong couple. We just solve the equation of motion for strings and read what the energy is. A priori, conceptually, I hope it's clear for everyone. Now let's go to gauge theory. Okay? So now we want the deltas. Okay? So how to compute these deltas now at weak coupling in perturbation theory? Okay, so this is what we are now about to do. So please tell me if there is any question. I'll just prepare the blackboards here. So, in quantum field theory, there is a direct relation, a direct connection between renormalization of operators and the scaling dimension of these operators. Scaling dimensions is a concept that exists in quantum field theory, not only in a conformal field theory, but actually in any quantum field theory. If you study the behavior of correlation functions, you have a large distance exponential fall off, say, if you have a massive theory. And when you zoom in a lot, you have a power-like behavior, and the power is given by some exponents, the power-like behavior, and those exponents, we can call them dimensions. In a conformal field theory, there's no exponential fall-off, there's only a power-like, and we want to come to compute the dimensions of these operators. But in both cases, either in a generic quantum field theory or in a conformal field theory, the way we compute these dimensions is by renormalizing the operators. That's very easy to understand. You see, normally, you say that an operator, suppose an operator phi, is not renormalized. So it means that when you compute correlation functions of phi, you get divergences. Then you understand, okay, phi is not a good object, it's not renormalized. But when I multiply phi by, say, cutoff to subnumber, I get an operator which now has finite correlation functions. So this is a renormalized operator. Okay, phi renormalized, which is cutoff to some power times phi. But now you look at this object and say, okay, what's the dimension of this guy? It's the dimension of phi plus the dimension that appears in the exponent of the cutoff, because cutoff has dimensions. So you have a correlation function of an operator of dimension, whatever power is in the cutoff plus the power of the bare operator. And that guy is finite and it has some fixed dimension. But then, just by dimensions, it must behave as 1 over x minus y to the power of that dimension. So you see that there is a direct connection between how do I need to renormalize my operators, what do I need to multiply them by, and what will I get in two-point functions of renormalized operators. It's literally the same thing. Whatever I need to renormalize them by is what will be the correction to their dimension. Okay? Was it clear? Yes? I will do it a bit slower, but I want this is the physical picture. Renormalized operators, by definition, they are obtained by renormalizing them, so they give them a different dimension, but then, of course, because they have a different dimension, two-point functions will have a different behavior. How it works in practice, it works like this. Let's take a conformal field theory with a single field, O. And then let's compute correlation functions of this field, O of x, O of y. Okay? So when we do it, what do we get? We get 1 over the distance, 1 over x minus y, to the power of whatever the engineering dimension, the classical dimension, the bare dimension, whatever I read from the Lagrangian. Say, if I take a scalar field, this dimension 1, whatever this dimension is, so this is the classical dimension, by just basically taking my operator O, and just connecting it. And then there are quantum corrections that will come from doing loops and so on. And so what do they give? They will give 1 minus lambda. There will be some number gamma. And then this effect, so lambda is the coupling, and then this effect will contribute to some logarithmic divergence that will be logarithm of the cutoff, and it should be dimensionless times x minus y squared. And in a CFT, these are the only divergences you get. Okay? So this is what you get if you start doing your perturbative computations. But then you conclude. Can you still see if I write here? Yeah? But then you conclude that the correlation function of an operator that I would call O renormalize x, O renormalize y, is equal to 1 over x minus y to the power 2 delta. Okay? Where O renormalized of x is equal to cutoff to the power 2 lambda to the power lambda gamma times O of x. This is renormalization. And delta is equal to delta naught plus lambda gamma, and these are dimensions. Do you agree? It's just trivial algebra that I did. I just wrote this as whatever is here to the power of lambda gamma, and I put the gamma part on the right-hand side and kept the x minus y part on the right-hand side. So this equation is totally equivalent to the last one with this definition. Okay? So you see right away, there is really a one-to-one connection between renormalization and dimensions of operators. So it's really exactly the same thing. If I know how to renormalize, if I know what power of the cutoff do I need to multiply in order to absorb the divergences, automatically I know what the dimension of the operator is. And again, another argument which doesn't require any computation is just to say Just looking here, I could have guessed a second line. Because you see, I write, there is an operator which has some classical dimension plus this anomalous dimension. Okay, but if that's the dimension, the correlation function is 1 over x minus y to that power. Right? We saw it here, but of course there was no need to do any computation. Just this guy has dimension, so this stuff here has dimension lambda gamma, because it's cut off, which is dimensionful to some power, and this guy has dimension delta naught. So of course the full thing has dimension of the sum, and therefore two-point functions must behave as 1 over x minus y to that power. Okay? So there is a direct connection. So what's the conclusion? What do we need to do? What's the recipe? So let me write here. What's the conclusion? Or the to-do list, if I want to compute the deltas in such simple CFT. One is compute the two-point function. Two, and that's it, basically. Look for the log of cutoff UV divergence. So do the two-point function. Look for terms which have log of the cutoff. The coefficient of those terms is gamma. So just take bare operators, compute two-point function, look for the divergence. That divergence is the anomalous dimension. So it's a simple computation. We should do two-point functions and find the log lambda divergences. Okay, any question here? This is for this very simplistic conformal field theories. Now we go to n equals 4, where we have many fields with the same classical dimensions. So now, n equals 4 super young Mills. The main difference is that now there are many fields OA with the same delta naught, right? For example, trace of ZZ XX and trace of ZX ZX. Both have delta naught equal to
Four,
to the number of scalars. So what do we do in that case? Let's repeat the same thing. Okay. I thought of doing it with a different color there, but since it's a very important point, I will really repeat it. Or do you feel I should just use that? Right, let me repeat. It's not that complicated. So now let's do it. OA of X, OB of Y. Now we get 1 over x minus y to the power 2 delta naught times the identity. Minus lambda, some number. But now this number will depend on which operators I put there. So now I get, if you want, this matrix. So this number that depends on which fields I put. If I put this and this, or this and this, and so on. Okay? So how do you go from this example, where now each choice of operators gives a different number, so that's the definition of a matrix, to the previous case, where I was just dealing with numbers and life was simple? So how do you go from the case when you deal with matrices to the case that you only deal with numbers? You diagonalize. So of course, this is a matrix, but so to go from matrices to numbers, we just diagonalize. So let's consider OA diag, which is defined by, which is equal to some linear combinations let's call it psi A B O B, some linear combination such that, in this case, linear combination of these two fields, such that gamma AB OA diagonal is equal to gamma B times O diagonal. What am I doing?
Is there a summing or B?
One second. So here there is a sum over B. Now, okay, the way to write it properly is to write this guy as a matrix, in the sense that you write this guy as operators, and on each operator, you know what gamma AB, how gamma AB acts. And this is some number times operator diagonal D. Okay? So this matrix, gamma, it acts as right? So it rotates all the operators in this way. Okay, nothing fancy again. So you consider this gamma AB, this matrix, that for each set of operators you get a number, and you diagonalize this matrix, and this gives you some linear combination of operators.
In the last
equation,
gamma has two indices. So how do you write it?
Sorry?
This gamma is a matrix, has two
indices. Right, so this is a matrix.
No, in the other side. In the other side of the equation.
Here? This is a number now. This is the eigenvalue. And this guy is the eigenvector. Okay? So we have a vector space, which is the space of all possible operators with the same classical dimension. Right? So that's our vector space. Right? For example, for delta equal 4, these are the only two possibilities. If I only want to have fields z's and x's. If I only want z's and x's, and if I want delta equal 4, these are the only two possibilities because of cyclicity of the trace. Either the two z's are close to each other or they are separated by one field. So it's a vector space of dimension 2. Then I consider the divergences when I put the two-point function between this and this, or this and this. And I make a 2x2 matrix. And then I diagonalize it and I find my operators that have that diagonalize this matrix. Okay? So once they are diagonalized, then OA diagonal with OB diagonal is just minus, or I can even put the delta AB up here, 1 minus lambda gamma A or B, doesn't matter, they are diagonalized, so it's the same, times log of cut off square x minus y square. So once they are diagonalized, I am exactly in the same setup as before. Unless I put OA and OB to be the same, I get 0, and when they are the same, then I am exactly in the same blackboard, where I just put an index A everywhere. Right? Is it clear? So this guy is the eigenvalue of this divergence gamma, and these guys are eigenvectors of gamma.
Should there be some power on x minus
1? Like sorry. 2 delta naught. Okay? So let's write here maybe. Can I write here? What's more, what's really the most general conclusion? Should I write here or somewhere else? Here it's fine? I can also raise that blackboard actually. So what's the conclusion for the prescription? What do we need to do? So let's summarize. So what do we have to do? First, we compute the two-point function between OA and OB. Then we look at the coefficient of the UV divergence. And that is a matrix that depends on which operators I choose, gamma, AB. Then we diagonalize that matrix. The eigenvalues are gamma A, and they are directly related to the anomalous dimensions. The eigenvectors are the operators with definite anomalous dimension. Again, so just take operators, compute two-point function, look at log lambda, we get a matrix, we diagonalize it, the eigenvalues are the gammas, the are the dimensions, the eigenvectors are the operators with good dimension. Okay?
Question?
Yes.
Does it follow from NFSS that the matrix gamma AB is going to be real?
Because the deltas should be real.
Yeah. But
the matrix will be Hermitian, yeah.
Okay, but when we just calculate the it using the Feynman diagrams, why are there not going to be any factors of I, etc. in the gamma?
If you do it in Euclidean, everything will be real. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So now the correction, like in the when we calculate the classical correlation function between A and B, we have the condition that the dimension of A and B should be the same. But now the correction in A and B are different. What does this physically?
That's right. So the degeneracy is lifted. Therefore, the two-point function of them that's written up there, A and B, it's only equal if A is equal to B once you diagonalize. So that's the usual story. Usually, what you write is that two operators with different dimensions, they don't have two-point function. And that's true. If you take two operators with definite dimension, if both of them have a definite anomalous dimension, unless they are the same, the two-point function is zero. That is true. That's what is written up there. There is a delta AB. Unless A and B are the same, and therefore they have the same anomalous dimension, the two-point function is zero. Right? But now, take two operators that have definite anomalous dimension. Call it O1 and O2. And compute correlation function of an operator which is O1 plus O2. So take O1 with O1 plus O2 with O1 plus O2. Of course, you get O1 with O1 plus O2 with O2. And you get two power-like expressions. So the total result is not power-like, but that's fine. You just did not take two operators with definite anomalous dimension. You sum, you create, you consider the mixture. Yes? So the ones that have definite anomalous dimensions is what we, in the jargon, just call good operators. Because if you take two of these good operators, you get just a power-like. Of course, you take a linear combination of every one, you get a bunch of sum of power-like expressions. So tomorrow, what we will do is we will do this computation. Now we have a recipe here. So we will take a class of operators in n equals 4. We will choose a subset of operators. So tomorrow, let me just prepare the ground for tomorrow. We will take operators OA, which are dual to operators moving in the sphere. Because you remember that we were so far studying mostly strings that are non-trivial in the sphere. But operators in the sphere, they are made out of scalars, right? So a very natural class of operators to consider are operators that are made of any of the six scalars of the theory. Phi I1, phi I2, phi IL. So A, in this case, that tells you which operator stands in this case for all this sequence of numbers that take values from 1 up to 6. So we will take operators of this kind, OA and OB, compute a two-point function between these operators, see what is the logarithmic divergence, write down a matrix, diagonalize it, and then learn what linear combinations of these scalars have definite anomalous dimension. And then those are the operators that should be dual to strings moving in the sphere. But really, today I don't want to go over time, so maybe I will actually compensate for previous days and stop 5 minutes earlier. Are there any questions? Or you can ask me questions to fill in these 5 minutes.
Okay, in this case, does J have to be integer?
J, in this particular case?
Yeah.
J needs to be integer. And in string theory, you see, you don't know how to quantize string theory, because as I said, it's very hard. But you do know some things. For example, you know that angular momenta should be quantized at Bohr-Sommerfeld. So that's what's called string semi-classical quantization. You compute the angular momenta, the charges of these strings in the sphere. Like we compute this J1, J2, J3, and you compute this J1, and J1 was given there. J1 and J2 were both related to this curly J. This curly J, a priori, is some continuous parameter. But now the first thing you would say is, by the way, that curly J must be quantized. Square root lambda times curly J over 2 must be an integer. Because that's like quantization of angular momenta, even from the string point of view. So even from the string, you would still claim that J1 and J2 are quantized, just because it's angular momenta and we should always quantize angular momenta. And these two integers will be matched exactly to the integers that tell us how many scalars of type x and z do we have.
And why are we not allowed to take non-integer powers of operators in it? Is it just not a valid local operator?
No, remember, what does it mean to take an operator to the power square? It means you have two matrices and you multiply them.
Yeah.
So to take square roots of matrices, it's not so well defined. It's some matrices in the gauge group, right? So when I write this, say some expression like this, means that I have Z, A, B, Z, B, C, Z, C, D, Z, whatever. Using this letter is not such a good idea, right? What can I do? I don't know. Capital A, B, X, B, C, X, whatever, F, A, right? And sum over all the indices. Let's say what something like this means, right? Where I have J1 of these fields and J2 of these fields, and these are gauge indices that go from 1 to n. So these are the natural operators. There are other gauge invariant operators that one can construct, not only traces of fields, but other kind of operators. But these are the most natural ones. More questions? So let me anticipate that what we are about to see is the emergence of strings, or at least one-dimensional structures, in the gauge theory. What are these one-dimensional structures which are the analog of the string? Well, they are here. Here is a one-dimensional structure. Look, you have phi I1, then you have phi I2, then blah, 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 and then phi IL. And all these fields, they are ordered. They are inside the trace. it's cyclic, but I have some order, some structure, and I cannot just change the fields and change their order. And you can think of these fields, you can think of this as being like sites of a spin chain, which is like a compact spin chain, where at each site of the spin chain you have 1 degree of freedom that takes values from 1 to 6. And that spin chain is like a discretized quantum version of the string that becomes classical at strong coupling. So we will see that the objects, tomorrow we will see that the objects that we have at strong coupling, these classical strings, admit a description at weak coupling, rather in terms of some generalized spin chains, generalized because at each side, say, we have a number from 1 to 6. And we can think of this object should smoothly interpolate, and this string should smoothly become a spin chain, and the spin chain should smoothly become a string. And somehow they are all uniquely defined by some object that we can give a name if we want that lives somewhere in between. So this will be, we will already starting to see the structure, what we will find that we couple, and this is the description that we have been working with at strong coupling. And the goal, as usual, is to do plots. Our ultimate goal, of course, is to be able to do some plot of delta as function of lambda. And what we did was to study this part in the beginning of the lecture. Tomorrow we will study this part. So this part is the spin chain part, and this part over here is the string theory part. So this is where we are aiming. Okay, so let's meet again tomorrow. The tutorial is tomorrow, right? Not today. But again, maybe we could put the tutorial already in the wiki, so that if you want to play more with some classical string solutions,